Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm sitting across from AC Grayling, Anthony Grayling, talking about his book, Democracy and Its Crisis. Thank you for coming in and talking to me, because a couple of years ago we got the chance to have a bit of a chat, and I wanted to go for a couple of days. You didn't let me do that, because it's a wonderful opportunity for someone like me to sit across from you to talk about what's going on in the world, what's going on with your writing and philosophy and the changes, especially with your book here, which is really aimed at now. It's a book for now, addressing the problems that all of us are feeling and are worrying about and concerned about. Was this a book that you just had to write?
I mean, I read it in a bit of a sort of white heat of passion as a result of the Brexit referendum and the Trump election, both of which are really the signatures of the fact that our rather imperfect but nevertheless could be made to work kind of democratic order in the West has really reached the tipping point. I've been thinking about these things for a long time, and wrote a book earlier, a book called Towards the Light, which was about the development of thinking about civil liberties, human rights, democratic structures, rule of law.
I have to say, that book is an incredible book. That's a book that I used to stand up and cheer and read some of the pages, because it needed to be said. And to have this sort of momentum that you tell that story and the development, how long it took to get where we are, and how many people struggled and had so much pain that was suffered to get to where we are, and for us to take it so lightly.
Absolutely. It was a real struggle. I mean, that's the only word for it. A lot of blood was shed to get the things that we've got now. And now we look at these institutions and we think, you know, they're not really functioning as well as they might be. That's been the problem for a long time. But we've kind of gone along with it. We've recognized that the political order and politicians and, you know, what happens in Canberra and Westminster, Washington, could be better. Now I think, however, we've really got to sit up and say the levers of these institutions, the mechanisms, have really been hijacked. Because what happened in the case of Brexit and Trump is that the efforts made by a particular political agenda-pushing interest group used to do it by, you know, propaganda, used to do it by standard traditional campaigning techniques. More recently, they began to realize that social media was very important to get the word of mouth out there. But this very powerful tool, the big data tool, so useful, so good in the natural sciences and in medicine, epidemiology, for example. But when applied in the social sciences to things like social attitudes, opinions, and election campaigns, it becomes a dangerous tool. And that's what happened in 2016. It was used in those two cases, the Brexit and the Trump cases, and it's used in a way that people weren't aware of. It was hidden, it wasn't transparent. The big money that was spent on it was spent outside the term of the Electoral Commission control of the money cap. And it was used in a way that, because it wasn't transparent, meant that people didn't know that they were being played, had been given distorted information, false information. They were being corralled, really, into voting blocks without realizing that they were.
That divide and conquer sense you got, where you get a sense that people were not getting any other kind of news. They're getting one kind of viewpoint only, wherever they turned. Mm. It was like they were being anticipated every turn they went, and there was their point of view being mirrored back. Or if they had a kind of a slight tendency for something, someone was there ready to blow it and see if it could turn into a bit larger flame and take over their whole thinking. There have been all these accusations about Russia and other outside interests in the Trump campaign. When you look at Brexit, who was the gainer in that?
Well, there's a particular group of people in the UK who want the UK to drop out of the EU for the following reason. As a member of the EU, we have consumer protection laws, we have employee rights, we have protection of the environment, we have a social welfare net, we have a form of capitalism which is not red in tooth and claw like the American version, but it's a sort of a softer welfare oriented one that is sort of commonplace among the European nations. And all those things are expensive, they require tax levels which are quite high. So there's a group of people who want the UK to crash out of the EU so that it can become a very low-tax, deregulated economy. Deregulated because you can get rid of all those consumer and environmental protections and employee rights and so on. Low tax because in order to get inward investment, you have to make it very, very, very attractive for investors to come in. And they, this group of people, stand to benefit from this. They're already pretty wealthy people. We can name them, and we know who they are because they're right at the very top of the Brexit campaign. People like Aaron Banks and Jacob Rees-Mogg and so on, they're all out in the public sphere saying these things, saying that they want to make a bonfire of the regulations. They want low tax. And they're not bothered that you can't have a good state education system in a low-tax country. You can't have a good health system, you can't protect the environment, you can't have welfare protection, because of course they're not interested in state education. They send their kids to private school. They're not interested in a national health service because they've got private medicine. They're not interested in protecting the beaches and the air quality of the cities because they have their holidays in the Maldives. So from their point of view, what they want is just to keep more of the money they've got already. But everybody else who was corralled into voting for Leave were aggregated together by this very, very clever big data technique, which works as follows. I don't want to bang on for too long here, but it's just interesting to know how this works, okay? It works as follows. When you trawl hundreds of millions of data points, you can profile individuals and groups with extraordinary accuracy. So accurate is the profiling that they could look at your Twitter feed, just a couple of your tweets or mine or something on Facebook or one of these podcasts. They can tell your gender, your age, your education level, what you do, how you're inclined to vote. In fact, they know us better than we know ourselves. Now, we know about this profiling. It's been going on for a long time because if you use Google as your search engine, for example, on the internet, we've known for a long time that it profiles you so it knows what adverts to send you. What people don't realize is that on the basis of that profile, it also, when you ask for information of some kind, gives you the information that it thinks you would like to have on the basis of your profile. Yeah. Now, that's pretty insidious, okay? Now we get to the real nub of the thing, which is that on the basis of the profile, these companies, and the big company in play in the Trump and Brexit cases was a company called Cambridge Analytica, the name of which I mention because I'm going to tell you something that should chill the bones of your Australian listeners here. And that is that they're able to test and test and test. In fact, they do it many thousands of times. Messages which they will target at these very small groups of people. It's called hyper-targeting. Very, very well-honed messages to very small groups of people. And those messages will so resonate with that group will be hooked. So if it's pro-Trump, okay, it will hook that little group of people to be pro-Trump. So a message for that little group, then a very beautifully tailored message for another little group of people, and yet a different message for another group of people. And these groups may have nothing in common. They may disagree with one another about everything else, but they've been brought together into one cohort. Mm-hmm. They've been aggregated, and they will provide their vote for the person you want to see elected. The point about that is you don't even need to get a majority. Trump had more than 3 million votes fewer than Hillary Clinton had, but they were the right votes in the right place. In the case of the Brexit referendum, the astonishing fact about that, make people sit up and think, what the hell's happening here, is that of the electorate that was enfranchised for the referendum, by the way, it was a restricted electorate. We know this also out in the public domain. But of that restricted electorate, only 37% of that electorate voted to leave. They were targeted with these messages, very distorting messages, oh, the EU is really bad for this reason and that reason and the other. Oh, we need to take back sovereignty. Oh, we, you know, could have our straight bananas or curved bananas or whatever nonsense people were saying. And it was enough on the day of the vote, because so many people thought that Remain was a done deal. Of course, we wouldn't be so stupid as to leave the EU. The bookies said it was more than 80% that Remain would win. So a lot of people didn't get out of bed for it. We don't have compulsory voting like you have here, which we should have. And as a result, that technique managed to get the vote to leave. Now, there is a worry, and I mentioned the name of the company, Cambridge Analytica, because when I was last here in Australia earlier in the year, on the day that I jumped on a plane to go back to the UK, who should land in Australia but the CEO of Cambridge Analytica on his way to see your Prime Minister.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful news. Thank you very much for that. There may be some people out there who are listening to this going, Sounds a bit far-fetched that there are these groups of people who are able to find, you know, getting good copy is hard, mm-hmm. you know, and find someone who's actually able to hit those targets with phrases and sentences which really turn people. Mm-hmm. How organized is it? And if you've got that kind of intelligence behind it, why are they so stupid to not know that they're actually going to... I mean, when I read about the Medici family in Florence, mm-hmm. They would go... they'd be living in Florence and they would want to go to their villa outside of Florence. It was in the 15th century or 16th mm-hmm. century. And they'd get robbed on the way to their villa and they'd have to have guards to get to their goddamn villa. And they were the lords of Tuscany. Mm-hmm. And because they're not sharing their wealth, they're not sharing mm-hmm. the brilliance of their... of the city-state with the people who live in it. So you've got this massive diversity between the rich and the poor. Yeah. These people are leading back towards that circumstance. Mm-hmm. They're going to have to fly their jumbo jets out of guarded airports and have guarded cities and guarded this and guarded that. Because
already happening, of course. You know, when you think about these high security suburbs and so on. Now you're absolutely right. Now, you raised two points there, which should be interesting. The first point is, if you get a chance, look online at a BBC Horizon programme, which was first broadcast. We're talking now, where are we, coming up to the middle of September, so just a few weeks ago in the UK. I'm sure it's going to be online now or soon. And this programme is about the Trump election. And it shows you the Trump campaign office, which was in an office block in Texas somewhere. And it shows you the office, now empty, of course. And next door was Facebook on one side, and next door on the other side was Cambridge Analytica. And in this program, it tells you that when they were using the profiling, the access to the social media reach that Facebook has, they were testing the messages, these hyper-targeted messages, to very, very precise small groups, up to 30,000 times until they got it absolutely right. Now, you may know, because you do a lot of online marketing, you know how to test whether people are showing an interest or clicking on or clicking through.
We might do it once or twice.
You may. So with this technique, they say that you have to be exposed to a message half a dozen times before you even notice that you're being exposed to it. But then they can tell from when people click on, how long they stay on it, whether they like it or whether they forward it to somebody else and so on. They can tell when the hook has gone into the mouth. Mm-hmm. So they can tell when this message is working. And this is why they iterate it again and again and again. I mean, even, it seems extraordinary, but we're talking about 30,000 times, but this is because there are algorithms. So they've got a message and they've got variations on it, and the algorithm plays the variations and pops in different words and different emotional levels and what have you, and it just sends it out all the time to these groups, and it measures the response to it, and then they know whether they've got the message right. Now, if you go back and you look on YouTube at a Trump speech, you're going to see him talking a lot of balderdash, which is the usual thing, but in the middle of it all, there is a sort of a necklace of little messages tailored to different groups of people. And when you hear a message, you know how it is when somebody says something that you've always thought, you think to yourself, well, that guy's really smart.
Yeah.
So you hear a message that really resonates with you. You think, he's my man.
Yeah.
And you don't listen to the other messages, don't care about them, because you've got the one that's really hooked you. And this is how they played it. Now, the upside of all this is that we've clocked this fact. Mm-hmm. We've seen that's how it's happened. And now people are aware of it, and now they're saying we need complete transparency. Who's sending these messages out, on whose behalf? We need greater sort of understanding of how these mm-hmm. techniques can be used to manipulate things and distort things. That business about the hacking that the Russians did, it's a conspiracy theory, the Russians are coming and so on. It's not just the Russians, by the way. I was talking to an Australian security official in your security services in Brisbane last week. And he was telling me, yes, the Russians are big players in this respect. They hack in. They hack into social media to put, as it were, pro-Trump messages and anti-Clinton messages, to really game the system out there. But it's not only the Russians. More or less everybody's doing it and doing it to one another. Second point you made was a really, really important point, which is about the rich having to protect themselves and build walls and have guards. And these people, these folks, like the ones I mentioned, who want Brexit or who want Trump in power in order to get their agenda through, and it's a low-tax agenda, it's a keep-my-money agenda. You're dead right. What they're inviting is an even bigger problem than the one we've got already. The problem we've got already is that inequality in society is incredibly toxic. It's very destabilizing. Creates a lot of resentment, a sense of injustice among people who are middle and low incomes, have seen their quality of life stagnating, and they're not getting ahead, and you know, and they see wealthy people getting even wealthier. In fact, since 2008, in almost all the advanced economies of the world, there's been stasis in the living standards of people in the middle and lower ranks of the economy, whereas the wealthiest couple of percent have seen their wealth increase fourfold in the last 10 years. Now that's going to create a lot of resentment, a lot of problems. So you get this kind of populist upswell. But you know what? It's the demagogues. It's Marine Le Pen and Nigel Farage and Donald Trump. Donald Trump, who is the least probable champion of the working man you can imagine. I mean, here's a multimillionaire, lives in a penthouse in, you know, Fifth Avenue in New York, and yet he says, I'm representing the blue-collar workers who feel left behind. Well, obviously, he's playing them too.
Hmm. Yeah, I've been listening to, just to make myself feel a little bit better, and it was strangely enough, it was on the recommendation of Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg. They went out, both of them, at different times in the last couple of years, to talk about Steven Pinker's book, The Better Angels of Our Nature. And that is a big book that slowly tells you that if you look at all the data, that we're actually, democracy is changing how things are and things are getting better. That's written before all this happened. I almost feel like your book is an addendum to that, but if we don't respect the democracy, the structure of the whole thing, then it will start to unravel. It will start to fall. Do you think we're at that point, or you think we're actually, because you said we've clocked it, are we able to swing it around?
Well, I very, very, very much hope so. Of course, we've got to this point. I think it is a kind of tipping point that if we are going to be vulnerable to being played by incredibly sophisticated systems which are operating out there in cyberspace in ways that we're not even sort of conscious of, because one of the points that your Australian security services guy made was that it's all very well to be thinking about how people can interfere with a particular election, but it's also that there are long-term plans afoot to swing opinion, you know, gently. So if you were Russia, for example, you might want the EU to be much less stable, much less of a coherent bloc agreeing on foreign policy matters. So you might say, yeah, it could take 5 years or even 10 years, you know, and little by little, just weaken it, get a lot of, you know, controversy going between one country and another about immigrants or refugees or defense policy, and just keep feeding, drip feeding, drip feeding, drip feeding, and people won't know that this is going on. So what we have to do is we've got to try to reclaim the system that we have at the moment, because the system we have at the moment was rather painstakingly worked out over the last few centuries. How do you put final political authority into the hands of the people? I mean, we each of us have a right as citizens to have a say, to have a voice in our own government and in the laws that govern us. But how do you get that from sort of breaking down into people quarreling endlessly in a kind of anarchy of opinions into sound government? Well, the way it was worked out by people like John Locke and James Madison and John Stuart Mill and Montesquieu and so on was to devise institutions and practices which would take the with the consent of the people, which would take their preferences as expressed in voting and so on into, you know, stable governmental outcomes. That's kind of the hope. Mm-hmm. It's not even idealistic, because we recognize that anything human is imperfect. It's never going to be completely perfect. And what we've learned, especially since the early 19th century, is that the people who populate these institutions, the professional politicians, they've learned how to game it a bit. They've learned how to make it work for them so they can get their agenda going. One of the main ways of doing it, of course, is by introducing very austere systems of party discipline, which means that our MPs, in fact, are no longer representatives of the people, they're representatives of the party interest. Mm-hmm. So, but we know that kind of thing, and we've kind of put up with it for a little while, I think too long now. So now we're saying to ourselves, well, in addition to the way the system has been kind of gamed, we've now got this new thing coming in. So what we've got to do is we've got to get back to a situation where representatives are genuinely representatives. They cannot be whipped into voting for anything that the administration happens to want. There's got to be real controls on the money spent on elections. There has to be real transparency about everybody who's involved in an election. In the case of places like the UK and the US, we need a much more representative voting system. You've got a decent, well, a better one here anyway. I know the Senate sometimes be a bit of a problem, but we've got a better system here. We need to lower the voting age and have more education about voting and government politics in our schools. And we need also to make sure that the even if MPs have to vote with their party on manifesto pledges, that in all other respects they vote their consciences. Mm. That's absolutely key.
So how big a part does education play in democracy? Because you could actually have, in this circumstance, with people playing the system, you could whip a large enough majority to actually rule, like we're seeing in Turkey, mm-hmm. where we're seeing the unravelling of democratic practices. Mm-hmm. That's my greatest fear, and that people would actually put up their hand and say, yeah, I don't need those freedoms, thanks, mm-hmm. And vote it out democratically. Yeah. What role does education play in that? Because I would have felt that a very strong public education system is kind of number one for making sure people are aware of the freedoms they have, the rules, the laws, the way in which they have to interact with others, to enlarge their imaginations, to be able to walk in the shoes of others, those sort of things. Mm-hmm. With the way that England's going, with the sort of decline in the public schooling and pulling back, is that just another way of undermining that democratic process?
Oh, John, you're so right about it, because, I mean, it's a really key thing. And it's not merely education about the democratic process and about politics and about civic responsibility and so on, although that is really important and that should be happening. I mean, we should be preparing people for the full responsibilities of mature citizenship directly. Mm-hmm. So they should know about parliament and voting and government and so on. But in addition to that, and this is where education should be coming into its own, we need people to become good, critical, skeptical thinkers, good at evaluating arguments and claims that people make, and good at evaluating information. So they need that too, so that when politicians offer policies or when there's a debate in society about something, they're very good at thinking about it. They also need to know history. We've got to know our history, because if we don't, we're going to make those mistakes all over again. That's really key. You talked about having an insight into other human beings. I mean, great diversity among human beings. So we don't share interests and desires and aims, ambitions with other people always. But to appreciate what those ambitions mean to them, even if we don't share them, you need that kind of sympathy.
And curiosity,
absolutely. And that kind of sympathy and curiosity comes out of reading, comes out of literature.
Yeah.
Because when you read, you're a fly on the wall in other people's houses and other people's lives. You vicariously have a sense of the experience that other people have that you may never have yourself. And to read reflectively and intelligently teaches you a great deal about the diversity of human nature. So direct information about the political and governmental process, and then critical thinking, sense of history, that the tremendous value that literature offers us in the way of insights into human experience. All these things are necessary, and a really good educational system provides an opportunity for people to drink from those fountains, so that when they get out there in the world, they can use their vote responsibly, they can relate to other people responsibly, they can think about what answer to give to the following question, which I think far too few people ask themselves, and that is, what is the good society?
Mm-hmm.
What would a good society be like? And what therefore would result in the way of a good life for we individuals as members of that society?
I have one last question or query to put to you. And I mean, I think in your position, you might know exactly the quote that I'm referring to, but I can't remember right at the moment. Plato, I think it was, and Socrates, says something about that we get if we don't involve ourselves in politics, we get the politicians we deserve or something.
Yeah, yeah.
Why, why aren't there more people like you, say, or entering into politics? I mean, this is a if people aren't doing it properly, shouldn't we be looking? Because you'll often see them turn to the best and the brightest, and always be some leader of business or something rather than an academic. I mean, we here in Australia we had the example of Peter Garrett, the lead singer of Midnight Oil, striding into the mess and limping out. Mm-hmm. So there's I'd say there's quite a few people who thought about, yeah, I'll do it, or maybe not.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good example, you see, because I'm sure a lot of people go into politics, with ideals and idealism and really wanted to make a difference and do something positive, and because they've got strong beliefs, whether on the left or the right. So they go in there wanting to try to apply their principles. A lot of people. I'm sure some people go in out of self-interest and, they've got an agenda. But the thing about politics and especially government is that you're doomed to fail in the end. The reason is that in a large populous, complex society with a lot of competing interests and differences in points of view and desires, you're stuck with having to make compromises and always, operating plan C and D and never getting plan A implemented. And as a result, you annoy first this group of people, then that group of people, then eventually all groups of people. Okay? Yeah. So if you're in politics long enough, you're going to end up failing. Mm. And failure is the destiny of politics. And it's just because of the sheer difficulty. It's herding cats. That's what it's like trying to govern. And all your ideals pretty soon get nailed down to the floor with these compromises and these half measures. So it's a very difficult game. And to some extent, you can kind of sympathize with people who might really sincerely have wanted to do some good and make a contribution, but then they find they're pulled and pushed, and famously, the members of your own party are your enemy, because they want to go in one direction, you want to go in another, and you have to come to some kind of accommodation with them, which is not fully efficient. That's the problem with government, unless you're in a tyranny. Now, I'm a big supporter of democracy for the two reasons. That firstly, democracy is noisy because there's a lot of discussion, debate, disagreement, people putting points of view, that's great. And secondly, I'm a big fan of democracy because democracy is inefficient. And inefficiency is a big protector of our civil liberties. If you live in a country with a very efficient government, like China, for example, you get very rapid economic progress, but at what cost? Mm. At the cost of not having the kind of personal liberties that make life worth living.
Yeah. We talked about reading before, and I think of reading as a form of defiance in these times, and readers are marching, in a sense, in the right direction by reading. And I think that anyone who gets hold of democracy in its crisis is leading that march, and I suggest that everyone get hold of it. Anyone who's listened to this conversation and either got fired up or started thinking about their role in their democracy that they're involved in, it's a very good place to start, to get your head together, get the ideas together. Thank you very much, Anthony, for writing it and coming in and talking to us.
Oh, thank you very much for having me. It's such a delight to see you, John, and to be back at Booktopia.
Thank you. And you can get all of A.C. Grayling's books at booktopia.com.au right now.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.